So, welcome everyone to our very first session of the 18th season of the Denver Community Kollel's Torah for Dakums program. As for the past 17 years, I would like to thank the Harry H. Baron Trust and Rabbi Zev Baron for its continuous sponsorship of Torah for Tycoons as we begin our 18th season. As I have announced in past classes, I want to encourage all of you to consider having conversation with the Kollel about the Kollel's life, Live On Life and Legacy program, which is organized here in Denver by Rose Community Foundation, and is helping the Kollel and many other Denver organizations create future financial stability through planned giving, such as wills, estate planning, endowments, and the like. And with that, without further ado, I'd like to introduce this evening's presenters besides myself, and as Dr. Daniel Ogioros, MD, infectious diseases specialist. And I want to just, before he starts, just thank him for coming once again. Those some of you were here a few months ago, and he was very kind enough to give of his time and expertise as we did a class on prioritization in vaccination. And as the world turns, so then everyone was queuing up to get the vaccination. And here we are having a conversation about people not queuing up to get the vaccination. So we're going to try to have a conversation about that this evening. So thank you very much for being here. And without further ado, doctor, please go ahead.
Thank you, Rabbi Fleischer. Can everyone hear me okay?
You sound fine to me.
Okay. So I want to cover a couple of topics related to COVID vaccines. First of all, the first thing I probably want to discuss is what we know about how effective the vaccine is. Now that it's been out for 7 months, 8 months, most people are sort of well into the time period that they've been vaccinated. How effective is the vaccine, in particular compared to those who are to not getting the vaccine? The second issue I want to talk about is the misperceptions and misconceptions about how dangerous or not dangerous or potential side effects of the vaccine that may make people somewhat reluctant and hesitant to get the vaccine. And then if we have time, depending on things, we can talk about, issues related to breakthrough, which is on a lot of people's minds because it's happening more and what that really means. So to start off with how effective the vaccine is. So if everyone probably remembers when the vaccines first came out, they talked about being 95% effective. And basically what that meant was that the risk of getting COVID was much, there was a 95% less chance of getting COVID if you were vaccinated than if you weren't. That was based on the original studies, which were relatively short studies compared to real and much fewer patients. The biggest study, probably the Pfizer study, had 40,000 people. There have now been 300 some million doses given in the United States, around the world. We're talking hundreds of millions of doses. So we have a much better idea of how effective the vaccine works. I think the best way to understand the vaccine efficacy is to actually look at some numbers and compare it to people who are unvaccinated. So if we take a look at what's going on in our own backyard, I looked at the numbers yesterday here in the state. There are about 800 people who are hospitalized with COVID. Of those, 95% are unvaccinated. So the vaccine clearly reduces the risk of someone getting hospitalized, which was what we would consider severe disease, by tremendous amount. I mean, basically, it's a fraction of what would happen if someone is unvaccinated. And this has been borne out in study after study. According to the State Health Department, the risk of being hospitalized is 7 times higher in unvaccinated people in Colorado. In California, there was a big amount of data that came out from Los Angeles County, showed a similar type of ratio, about 6 times. And that's just, that's hospitalizations. When you're talking about death, the ratio of people who die from COVID, who are unvaccinated compared to vaccinated, it's about 25 times higher, people who die if they're unvaccinated. So we know the vaccines work at preventing severe disease, which is really what the important thing is. We don't want people to get very sick and die from this. The other thing is we don't want people to get sick and develop what's called long COVID, which are these symptoms that you've probably read about where they have problems that will go on for months and months. It can be breathing problems. It can be neurological problems. It can be all kinds of problems. And it turns out that getting vaccinated, even if you get COVID when you're vaccinated, reduces the risk of getting long COVID by at least 50%. So at this point in time, you know, when we look at the vaccinated population versus the unvaccinated population, it becomes clearly evident that people who are vaccinated have a much lower risk of developing severe disease that puts them in the hospital and potentially dying from the infection. I'll just make a quick statement about breakthroughs here because that fits in and to help understand this vaccine. The vaccine is not going to prevent people from getting COVID at all. I mean, so it's not going to make you immune entirely for the rest of your life. It's not designed to work that way. There are really no vaccines that are in this, no vaccines that actually do that. And there are many reasons why this one doesn't do it also, but I think the expectation has come around that this vaccine is going to keep people from getting COVID. And that's not true. It's going to keep people from getting very sick with COVID. And it's going to take COVID from a potentially fatal illness to something like getting the flu or getting a cold. That's sort of, I think, an important thing to remember. Even when we think about vaccine efficacy and the breakthroughs, it's still very effective at preventing the severe disease, which is what we are worried about. Certain populations also we know, sort of subpopulations we know benefit from the vaccine. So, for example, I mean, we know older people clearly benefit from the vaccine. We also have found that pregnant women have a much higher risk of severe disease and death if they're unvaccinated. And clearly it's become obvious that pregnant women do better if they're vaccinated. And that's going to become an issue when we talk about what some of the misperceptions are about COVID vaccines. Now, which vaccine? They're all pretty good. They all seem to have a similar rate of efficacy when it comes to preventing severe disease. So whether it's the J&J vaccine, whether it's the mRNA vaccines, the difference is in really maybe how much they prevent mild infections and also the time frame you're looking at. And that's one thing that we now have a different perspective on with vaccines because, like I said, we've now given 8 months worth as opposed to when it's got approved, it's been a much shorter period of time. So it seems like maybe vaccine efficacy improves for some period of time and then starts to wane. So that's something that still needs to be looked at further. But the bottom line is that the vaccine is very, very effective at preventing severe disease and death. So that's why there's such a push out there for people to get vaccinated, because we know the data is clear on how effective it is. The pushback comes because there are concerns about various potential side effects, adverse effects, and which some of them are to some degree legitimate, some are not so much. So one thing that did come out, and legitimately so, was the issue of getting myocarditis or inflammation of the heart muscle in people who got particularly the mRNA vaccines. And this was found to be the case, particularly in young men, teenage boys, young men seemed to be the risk. And it definitely was more than we would expect from just normal, you know, every day. If we took a random selection of young men ages 14 to 25 and compared it to the same group who had gotten a vaccine, we were finding more cases of heart inflammation in that group, without a question. However, when they looked at the risk of heart inflammation from COVID itself, which we know can happen and is well described and actually is often the cause of death in younger people who get COVID, the rate of heart inflammation in COVID patients was actually much higher than vaccine recipients. So while the risk compared to a normal situation was higher, the risk compared to actually getting COVID and getting heart inflammation was lower. So that was one thing that had some people hesitant, but it's become apparent now that if you have to compare the right sets of data. The comparison is not vaccine to a normal unvaccinated population. The comparison really is vaccinated to COVID patients. And the truth is, I think there's maybe only one or two deaths that were related to this phenomenon in vaccinated patients. The vast majority of these cases were pretty mild, resolved on their own with no lasting side effects to heart function. Another issue came up with the J&J vaccine, very prominently reported on, was blood clots. And this was something that was happening in basically young women, childbearing age women. Again, this was happening more so than the regular population we would expect. But the same kind of situation here. When people looked at the risk of blood clots in people that got COVID, it was much higher in COVID patients. And we know that. The risk of dangerous and severe blood clots in COVID patients is much higher than almost any other viral infection that I've ever seen. And so, again, you have to look at the right data. When you look at the right sets of data, vaccinated versus COVID, it becomes apparent, obvious, that COVID gives you a much higher risk of getting severe blood clots than the vaccine does. So those are two issues that had legitimate medical bases to them and were investigated. And the data is now clear that it's still safer to get the vaccine than to get COVID itself when it comes to these issues. Then there have been other issues that have come up that are a little more tenuous in terms of their association. So one issue that has been bandied around a lot has issues related to fertility. And this is clearly an important issue and one of concern potentially in Jewish communities, because, you know, we know that families are very important and people worry about fertility. So there have been, and they're unsubstantiated by the data, but claims that somehow the vaccine affects fertility. This has been looked at, again, by multiple studies here in Israel, and there's no evidence that the vaccine impairs fertility either on the part of women or infertility in men. It has no effect on that. And conversely, as I mentioned before, pregnant women actually have a significantly higher risk of severe disease and death than other women of the same age who are not pregnant. And so actually the vaccine, rather than impairing fertility, actually likely, you could say, I wouldn't say improve fertility, but improves the chances of a woman avoiding getting COVID, getting severe disease, dying. I mean, I've seen this happen. I've seen pregnant women where they had to be rushed for an early delivery, C-section, because they're on the ventilator. I've seen pregnant women die from COVID. So really the vaccine, rather than impairing fertility, it actually is important for pregnant women to be vaccinated because of the high risk of death and fetal loss that comes with COVID. Another thing that's been out there is the issue of somehow the vaccine can somehow do something to people's DNA. And this is based on basically a misunderstanding of how the vaccines work, particularly the mRNA vaccine. So the mRNA vaccine, what it does is the COVID virus is an RNA virus. That's what it's called. But basically, what happens when the virus gets into a cell, it uses the cell's machinery to produce something called mRNA, which is a copy of the genetic code of the virus. And then the cell translates that into new virus, into the components of a new virus, gets packaged together, breaks out the virus, and then spreads through the body. Now, the virus, a human cell has two parts to it. There's the nucleus, which is where the DNA is. And there's the cytoplasm, which is where all this packaging happens, where the virus is. The way these mRNA vaccines work is basically they take a piece of this they take a piece of these copies of the gene for the spike protein. So it's not even the entire virus. It's just a copy of the gene for parts of the spike protein. It gets taken up into the cell. And in that cytoplasm area that's outside the nucleus, away from the human DNA, a copy gets made. It gets displayed on the surface of the cell, and the immune system recognizes it as foreign. In the meantime, the mRNA that was injected probably disappears within 48 hours. mRNA cannot go back into the nucleus. It's not physically possible. There's no mechanism for mRNA to go into the nucleus. mRNA is always formed, used, and then degraded out in the cytoplasm. So there's no way for any gene from the virus to become incorporated into human DNA. And so therefore, there's no way to mutate the human DNA because the genes or this mRNA that's being injected never comes in contact with human DNA. So that concern is one that is based on a misunderstanding of how this works. And this is not new technology. This has actually been around for probably 20 years. It was originally being used to try to come up with treatments for cancer, but it was then adapted when COVID came to try to see if we could use it that way. Another misconception is that people who are vaccinated now are shedding virus. And as I just said, there's no virus ever being injected in the person. There's no virus being made within the person's cells. Because to make virus, it would require the entire genetic code of the SARS-CoV-2 virus. But that's not what we're injecting with these vaccines. We're just injecting a small, tiny portion of one protein's genetic code. So people cannot produce virus in their body from vaccines. And then start spreading it to other people. It's not possible. It's biologically not possible. But a lot of people have claimed that that's the case. And so people who are actually getting the vaccine are spreading virus more than people who are sick. So that's another misconception that has led people to decide that they don't want to get the virus, get the vaccine. Then I think the final misconception, and one that I think is also important to understand. It has to do with some people think that I'd be better off getting immunity from the virus, or I had COVID already, so I don't need to get the vaccine. And so with regards to the first claim, as we mentioned before, the vast majority of people do okay with COVID. You know, we're not talking that it's not a virus that kills large percentage of people. But within the group that's unvaccinated, we know that the chance of getting very sick and dying are higher. So there's always a risk being taken by saying, I want to get this naturally, rather than get vaccinated. Because we don't really know yet why certain people get very sick and why some don't. There are a lot of factors that are genetic, other things that we don't really understand yet. And so we don't recommend that people say, I'll just get naturally because I'm 25, 30 years old and I'll be fine, because I can tell you they're not always fine. I've seen people in their 20s die of COVID. And so that's why the fallacy of that argument is that you are gambling. It's definitely a gamble. And I think it's not a gamble that makes sense to take, especially since we know the vaccine is effective and safe. The other issue, it becomes that people who've had COVID and now question, should they get vaccinated? And this, I think, has a little bit more substance to it. The idea is, if I already had COVID, then my immune system has seen this before. I have some degree of immunity. And that is true. There's no question about that. But the problem is that immunity can wane after some time. We don't know how long that is. Not everybody gets the same degree of immune response in terms of how robust it is. And particularly people that had a mild COVID infection initially may not have gotten much of an immune response. And so in people who had COVID and then get vaccinated, there's several studies that show that they have a 50% lower chance of getting COVID a second time than those people who had COVID and didn't get vaccinated. So again, it's not as clear cut as people who didn't have COVID, who didn't get vaccinated at all versus vaccinated, but there clearly is benefit to people who had COVID going ahead and getting vaccinated anyways. And then the other issue with vaccinated is we now are finding out that people get the breakthrough infections. They, first of all, tend to be less sick. The vast majority of the time they're less sick. They tend to be less contagious in terms of the amount of virus that they're shedding. And they're shedding virus for less time. So being vaccinated, even though someone could get it, and right now we're talking about maybe 60, in Colorado, 25% of the cases are breakthrough cases. But those people are not as sick. They're not spreading it as far. And it's important because we still have segments of the population, namely kids under 12 who can't get vaccinated. And we have people who the vaccine doesn't work on because their immune system is not going to respond to it. And so, again, from a sort of a public responsibility, civic mindedness, getting the vaccine does help limit the spread of this, even though it may not 100% prevent someone from getting it, it does lower the chance that they're going to spread it to somebody else. And with the Delta variant that we have now, this is an extremely contagious variant. Unvaccinated people have spread it very readily. There was a case just a couple weeks ago in California where a first grade teacher who was unvaccinated had a cold-like symptoms, nothing major. She was reading to a class without her mask for about 30 minutes, and 12 out of the 18 kids got COVID. So it's extremely contagious, extremely easy to spread if you're not vaccinated. So I think the bottom line is that I think the evidence is very strong that the vaccine works. It works well. It's very effective at preventing severe disease and death. It's very safe. And the true adverse reactions that are attributable to vaccine are much less than what would happen if someone actually got COVID. The risk of that, if they got COVID, is much higher. A lot of the things that people that are out there in terms of fertility issues, genetic manipulation, I'm not going to talk about microchip insertion because I think that's a little crazy, but things that may actually be somewhat scientifically oriented have been shown to not be correct. And then finally, there's this issue of the civic mindedness. You know, we all live together. We're all trying to get through this together. And the vaccine does help protect others as well. And so I think I'm going to leave it there. And I'm sure there'll be questions as we go on. But unless Rabbi Fleischer, you want to take questions now, or you want anything else specific to address?
I think we can have questions now. Also, if you have a moment to address the vaccine, you know, if there are greater concerns besides children under 12, what about teenagers? You mentioned the fertility concerns in terms of, you know, pregnant women being more at risk. But what about a 15-year-old, let's just say a 15-year-old Basiako girl,
right?
Who is not going to be expecting anytime soon. Is there concern in terms of the general health for teens as opposed to adults? And you discussed the fertility. Is there any concern at all for the fertility, or is it just unfounded rumors as far as those fertility concerns?
So for teens, like I said, so for teens, there's only one vaccine that's available. It's the Pfizer vaccine. And this issue of the myocarditis, the heart muscle inflammation, was a legitimate issue. That is a legitimate issue. It happens almost exclusively in teenage boys, teenage early 20s boys, not girls, for reasons that are unknown. But when you look at the data, it's obviously much, much more, almost exclusively boys. It like I said, it tends to be mild. It tends to be easily treated. There seem to be no lasting effects. They don't develop heart disease of any kind. So that's one issue that we've seen in teenagers. Now, with regards to the fertility issue, where this all came out was somebody way back when, and this went online viral, somehow somebody put out there that the antibodies to the spike protein that get produced, the spike protein is very similar to some of the placental proteins that allow the placenta to attach to the uterine wall. And so therefore, if you produce these antibodies to the viral spike protein, they're going to attack a placenta. This was never true. There's no such similarity between the spike proteins. And this was looked at in studies, and there was never, these antibodies never attacked any placental tissue. But it took hold. And so that was, I think, the first instance where this issue of fertility came up. But it's not true. It doesn't happen. The second thing is, I think there's a concern because of this mRNA And in the tangential way, it does involve genetic material. There's a concern, could it lead to basically changing genetic structures in the ova and things like that, leading to presumably to congenital defects. And if a teenage girl gets it now, does it do some damage to her ova that then when she gets pregnant, has children, that's going to lead to congenital defects. Again, it comes back to the fact that that can only happen were the mRNA to be able to incorporate into the human DNA. But it cannot, because it can't get anywhere, number one, it can't get anywhere near the human DNA. And number two, mRNA can't really be translated back into RNA, then back into DNA. It's a complicated system that exists with DNA. DNA is much harder to mutate and change than RNA is, which is why this virus tends to mutate more than other viruses do. It's an RNA virus. But the people heard mRNA and they thought RNA and DNA and think it's all genetic material. It is only in the sense of mRNA is composed of the same molecules that RNA is, but it functions there very differently. It doesn't code for anything lasting in terms of anyone's genetic structure. It's basically a messenger. It's basically the way the body, the way the DNA and the RNA and the nucleus send the telegram out saying, do this. That's what it is. It's just a telegram, essentially. And they send these instructions out to the various cellular apparati that exist in the cytoplasm, say, produce this kind of protein. mRNA is, that's all it is. It's just the message. And so all we're doing basically is we're injecting the message. The message can't, just like a letter can't come back and rewrite itself or rewrite the person who wrote the letter and change what he writes. Same thing here. It's just a message. It's just a letter. It can't do that. So there's no concern, in that regard of causing any type of congenital birth defects or any type of genetic manipulation, because it can't do that. It's not mRNA. That's not what it does. And it's not how it works. And there's no mechanism for that. These are the only issues that come out of the mRNA vaccines. If for some chance in the future, the Johnson & Johnson, vaccine were to be approved for teenagers, which I don't think it will be, then you have this issue of clots in young women, presumably teenagers as well. But clotting disorders can affect pregnant women and cause loss of pregnancy. They don't really cause fertility problems in and of themselves unless women are pregnant. But I could almost guarantee the FDA will never approve that for use in younger women because of this reason. So really there are the fertility issue, I think, is a red herring. It's clear. And there have been tests done on male sperm also to see if there's a study out of Israel where they looked at that. They found the vaccine didn't affect that either. So all this is not true. It's not scientifically accurate at all. There's not even a tangential possibility that it's scientifically accurate at this point. So I would not be concerned about fertility issues in teenagers. Teenagers can get as sick as adults. That's what we have learned, that if something happens around the age of 14, when it comes to COVID, that teenagers 14 and up act more like adults many times than they do like younger children. And so physiologically, it's important to think of them that way. I tend to think of them as adults more than kids. Now, with regards to just quickly vaccine in younger kids, it's a whole different question. And it had the dosing is different. Safety issues may be different. Immune responses are different in younger kids. So that's why it's taking so long to get younger kids the vaccine. But I strongly urge that, I think it's important that kids, teenagers get the vaccine, because they can be just as contagious and just as sick as adults can. The fertility issue, any potential issues are no different than, a woman in her 20s potentially have the same fertility concerns as a woman in her teens. And we gave it to women in their 20s, and I think no one thinks twice about that because of their age. I think same is true in teens, but there are no fertility concerns with these vaccines. And if there were, we would have seen it already. It's been out for long enough. that and women who've gotten have gotten pregnant, and we have there's been no signal at all that there's anything related to fertility, congenital defects, things like that.
Okay, thank you. If there are any questions before I begin, and again we are as always, you know, we have the hour time slot over here. We have about a half an hour left, so if there are any questions, now's your chance. And then once I start talking, I'm going to try to plow through as much as I can in the time we have, and then I'll try to get to questions at the end.
Doctor, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
It's actually not my question. It's something that someone brought up to me, but I just would like to hear how you would respond to this. You know, and because in the when COVID was going on, a big obviously suggestion is you don't know what the long term effects of this. So and that happened. COVID happened very fast. So some people, the vaccine also seems to have been happening very fast. And the people say to me is, well, if COVID, we don't know the long term effects, why are you saying the vaccine doesn't have? How do you not know that the vaccine doesn't have a long term effects? What would be your answer to that?
So if you look, you have to look at the reason why COVID has long term effects. The long term effects from COVID are related to the over-exaggerated immune response that comes from the actual infection in some people. That you don't get the same kind of what was called a cytokine storm, which is basically it's just, you know, it's a blunt type of response. It's not a very targeted response. And so there's a lot of collateral damage that gets done by the immune system. And that's what we believe leads to long COVID, to all these things. The vaccine does not give the same kind of immune response. You don't get the cytokine storm. There's something about the virus itself. It's actually the virus itself, the whole virus that stimulates the cytokine storm. The vaccine can't do that. It's missing those components necessary to do that. Yeah, people can get pretty sick for a couple of days because they get a very strong immune response, but it's not the broad, untargeted, throw the kitchen sink kind of immune response that comes with sometimes with COVID. And so there's no reason to think that people will get long-term effects like that because the physiology is totally different. It doesn't, the whole mechanism that leads those things doesn't ever happen with the vaccine. The other long-term things that we talk about, fertility, you know, things I just discussed, I mean, we have now 9 months. If you look at the trials, we're talking well over a year of people who've been vaccinated. And in every previously known vaccine, side effects have appeared within the first few months. I mean, the most common case was a vaccine to swine flu, I believe, that led to something called narcolepsy, where people start just falling asleep, a neurologic problem. That appeared within weeks of getting the vaccine. So if you're going to see side effects of vaccine, it happens very early. No other vaccine that we know of has ever been shown to suddenly show up with side effects 20, 30 years down the road. Now, I'll grant this is a new type of technology, although not that new. The issue of how fast the FDA approved it has to do with, number one, basically the FDA dropped everything else, and the drug companies dropped everything else. And so when you pour hundreds of billions of dollars into one project, you're going to get it done faster and get the data there faster. I think that's part of the issue. Number two, the technology, because it's new technology, it allowed them to just make the vaccine faster. There was a lot of lead time that other vaccines required that never required here, not because they weren't testing for safety, but this mRNA technology is so sophisticated. And, you know, I read an article that said within a week of them identifying the genetic code of the virus, they had the vaccine already made. That's unheard of with previous vaccines. It takes years to come up with the right formula for the vaccine. So I think that cut down a lot of time. Yeah, did they push it a little bit? They did push a little bit. That's why it was an emergency use authorization, taking into account the fact that maybe we will see something, and once we get into hundreds of million people, it's going to be a problem. We've not seen that to be the case now. I'd venture to say it's close to 500 million doses have been given. And so now it's actually the Pfizer vaccine is fully approved, totally by the FDA. So that means the FDA looked at it and said, we have no concerns about safety. I think that's the answer. I think is that mechanistically, there's no reason to be concerned. And the fact that it came out fast isn't an indictment on the vaccine. It's just a recognition of the unusual reality of this particular thing. It's a vaccine that gets designed very quickly. And basically, every pharmaceutical company dropped everything else they were doing and put the money to try and figure out this vaccine. And when you get that kind of money going into a project, it's going to get done fast.
Okay.
Rabbi Fleischer?
Yes.
Hi, it's Elaine Hayitson.
How are you?
And I'm great. Wonderful. Thank you. And Sheldon and I have a question regarding, we first had COVID, then we had both of the vaccines, and out of curiosity, because everyone's getting the booster, I decided to go in and have my antibodies tested, and they came back very high, greater than 2,500. And my doctor called to tell me to wait to get the booster because it could be more harmful than good, and be tested again in a few months until the antibodies start to wane and get less. And so I'm wondering what is I don't know anything about antibodies and what the number would be on an average for an average person, and why 2,500 seemed to be so great.
Yeah, that's not a question for me. Yeah, but go ahead. I think if we just try to keep it brief, so we can get
to briefly answer your question, we know that people who had COVID and they got the vaccine have extremely high antibody levels, much higher than anybody else. Except for maybe people who got vaccinated and then got COVID. We don't know what the answer to that is. The issue with antibodies is that we don't exactly know what level of antibodies is protective. We don't know that information. There are some studies that suggest maybe 1,000 is very good. I think over 2,500 is more than adequate, it would seem, although we don't know that for sure. We don't know really if people in your situation need a booster, because we know they get a very good antibody response. So that's not been determined. I don't think I would say that getting a booster would be harmful. I think I would say you'd feel it a lot more. You'd probably get a pretty significant vaccine reaction afterwards. You'd get over it. It wouldn't be dangerous, but it'd be quite uncomfortable and miserable. And
with both of the vaccines, I did get very, not really sick, but for 2 days, I was very bad.
Right, and more and more reports are coming out that the third one is making people even feel worse. So in your case, I would agree with your doctor. I would not advise you getting the booster. I also think you don't need to check the antibodies all that frequently, because at that rate, at that high level, the rate at which they decay is going to take a while. So every check-in, maybe 3 months, 6 months. But again, we don't exactly know how much you need. There's some papers out suggesting maybe somewhere at 500 to 1,000, maybe less than that. We don't know. We don't entirely know. But at 2,500, you're more than fine, I think.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Okay. All right. So thank you very much, Dr. Mogiros. I'm just going to share my screen here so that we can go through some of the sources. And I think this time I remember to blow it up, so you should be able to see it on the other end. I have a lot of sources. I don't think I'll have time to go through all of them, but I do want to hit on several important points. So first off, just a little bit, just in the background, just in terms of halachic obligations of health and some older discussions, you know, from a few centuries ago about vaccines and about epidemics. So first off, of course, we have a pretty well-known passage in Maimonides, in the Rambam, where he says that any obstacle that poses a danger to life, there is a positive commandment to remove it and to guard from it and to be very, very careful in the matter. As it says, guard yourself and guard your life. Many things were forbidden by the rabbis because they pose a danger to life. So there is actually a mitzvah, an obligation in the Torah to take care of one's health. So when we discuss these questions, we're really discussing not just a practical question of taking care of one's health, but actually a mitzvah in the Torah of taking care of one's health. Now, the Teferis Yisrael, which is a commentary on the Mishnah, he says as follows. He is talking about the inoculation for what he calls pakin, which is smallpox. And the very first, if you want to call it, vaccine that was created in modern history was the vaccination for smallpox, created originally, if I'm not mistaken, by Edward Jenner, who watched the cowmaids not really get terribly sick from smallpox because they got a minor, they got inoculated, so to speak, from the cowpox, the cows. And so he went ahead and he infected people with cowpox, and they got mildly sick, but then were by and large protected from smallpox. That's not to say everyone reacted that well, and I don't think the FDA would have approved his methods back then, but that was the first vaccination, and it spread around the world. And there are discussions in halacha from that era about whether or not to use the smallpox vaccination. And the Teferis Yisrael in Yuma, when the Mishnayos talk about guarding one's life during the fast of Yom Kippur, and sometimes a person has to eat, he says, even though one out of every 1,000 may die due to the inoculation, I don't know if that was an actual study or he was just guesstimating, nonetheless, since if one contracts natural pakin, the danger is much closer. That's a literal translation. It's a much more dangerous situation. One may put himself in a distant danger in order to save himself from a closer danger. And this is an important idea which he's putting out, which comes up in halacha. And that is that you have a distant danger, meaning a danger that is less likely or we are less convinced of, there's less evidence, whereas the smallpox itself is far more fatal, is far more dangerous, and therefore he says even though there are some dangers with the smallpox vaccination, but because it is a much less likely danger, so then it is preferable to use the smallpox vaccination even though there is some danger, because the smallpox itself has a much higher fatality rate. And really, you know, if we were to stop here, this really does lay down a major argument in favor, and for those who are going to get nervous that I'm only going to skew in favor of, don't worry, I will try to present another side to the conversation. But this certainly does seem to be in favor that when you have a question, yes, there may be a risk and so on, but you have to weigh, as Dr. Mogir has mentioned, you have to weigh what is your risk benefit of how dangerous is it not to vaccinate and what percentage of people are losing their lives when they don't vaccinate versus what percentage of people are losing their lives when they or getting seriously ill or so on when they are vaccinating. And that's over here clearly saying that you have to worry more about the closer danger despite the quote-unquote distant danger from the vaccination. Now, moving along to source 3, we have a passage from the Rama. The Rama is in the Shulchan Aruch, and he says, so too one should guard from all things that bring to danger. Again, echoing the words of the Rambam, of Maimonides, for danger is more stringent than prohibition. That's an idea. We say chamira sakanta meisura, that danger is, we are more stringent in some ways when it comes to danger to our health than actual prohibition when something is forbidden. And therefore, he says, one must flee a city when there's an epidemic in the city, and one must flee at the beginning of the epidemic and not at the end. So he's saying this is an obligation. When there's an epidemic in a city, you have to get out because it spreads, it's contagious, and therefore there's an obligation to flee. Obviously, in this case, we did the opposite. We locked down instead of fleeing during the course of the epidemic. But the idea that during an epidemic, you have to deal with the realities and take action to protect yourself is there. And then the Be'er Heitiv was a commentator on the Shulchan Aruch. He adds, he says, in the name of the Shulah, who's one of a 16th century Torah authority, it says that he says that everyone must send his children away from the city at this time. And if they fail to do so, then the parent is liable for the children's lives. So here, the halacha lays the responsibility of the child's health at the parent's doorstep. That the parent has to take care of the child's health. And in the case of an epidemic where there are Muslims, you have to flee, So then the parent has to take care of the child as well. In the broader context of vaccinations in general, which is not our discussion today, but I actually did a class. We did a class on that about 6 years ago with Dr. Noah Mikovsky. We had a conversation then about the parent's obligation to vaccinate a child from other diseases. That's not our discussion today. But that is obviously very, very relevant in that conversation. But here as well, again, the question comes up, the parent's responsibility is not just for one's own health, but a parent has to also take into account the child's health and is responsible for the child's health as well. So that's a little background in general about vaccinations and about, in general, the obligation to guard one's own health, both in general and during an epidemic, and as well as one's children's health during an epidemic. This brings us to a very, very important idea over here. And that is this passage right here, God guards the fools. That is a literal translation of the verse, Shomer Pisoyim Hashem, which we actually say in Psalms when we say Hallel. Some would translate the word Pisoyim not so much as fools as simpletons or simple people. Okay. Now this verse has an application in various places, but what's relevant to our conversation over here is a very important idea, and that is this. When something becomes normal in society, even if there's a risk, then it's not considered endangering one's life. Let me give an example. Driving a car is very dangerous. Okay, unfortunately, the fatality rate of people who travel in cars is far higher than people who don't travel in cars. There are accidents, there are fatalities, there are injuries. That is the reality. Do we say driving in a car is dangerous and therefore don't drive in a car? We don't say that from a halachic standpoint. The reason is because since that became the norm in society, everyone travels in cars, virtually everyone. It's the norm. It's normal. So we invoke this idea. God takes care of, we'll say, the simple people. In other words, we are simple people. We are living our lives. We're trying to follow the dictates of what God expects from us and to guard our health, but to live our lives as well. And if you have to worry about everything and anything and everything that's normal in society, so then it becomes nigh well impossible to live your life. And so we have this idea that once it becomes the norm, you turn to God and say, God, I did my part. I'm living my life in a normal fashion. I'm taking care of my health, but this is normal. And therefore I am going to engage in it. And then it becomes God's problem, so to speak. It's always God's problem, but it's not our problem anymore, but rather God takes care of us and it becomes his problem exclusively, so to speak. And this idea is applied to medicine as well. The reality is that medicine, like everything else as technology continues to advance, the reality is that medicine is constantly changing. What was acceptable 50 years ago is very often not acceptable today, and on the contrary, would be spurned. What we're doing today, I'm not a doctor, but I would guess that what a lot of things that are done today and 50 years from now will not be practiced anymore, will be spurned, will be rejected, will be looked at as archaic and backwards and so on. Medicine, yes, there probably is a border somewhere where you can say the advent of modern medicine where things took a drastic turn in a different direction. But in the broader picture, medicine is constantly evolving, constantly changing in terms of what we do. Should one get up and say, well, whatever we're doing today in medicine is going to be, or a lot of things, will be looked at in 50 years from now as being wrong, so don't do it now. You don't say that. Why? Because today that's the norm. Okay, and this is a major argument, again, without going down that rabbit hole of childhood vaccinations, and that question of should children be vaccinated, and the whole anti-vaxxer camp, and the measles outbreak, which happened a few years ago, and so on. Everyone forgot about that measles outbreak as soon as COVID showed up. But that question, do we rely on the medicine as it is now? The answer is yes. What's normal now is what one should do. And in as much as the Torah says you have to guard your health, and the doctor says this is the treatment, this is what you need to do to take care of your health, this is what modern medicine accepts as being valid treatment, and since that's the norm, that's what society does, so then that becomes part of the obligation. Okay? And failure to do so brings us to source number 6. Whoever can save the life of another and does not save has transgressed. You shall not stand by your brother's blood. Okay. And so potentially not engaging in proper medical treatment or let's say in the case of a pandemic, not being vaccinated, where you could have been, and thus potentially exposing other people to the disease who are vulnerable, may well fall into source number six. Okay, now this is a little stickier. Let me explain this for a moment in terms of the Torah obligation. If I don't want to be vaccinated, let's just say I don't want to be vaccinated, and I say I'm taking the risk on myself. So someone says, you have a higher chance of dying, and I say, that's okay, I'm willing to take the risk on myself. But the problem is that if I'm not vaccinated, then, as the doctor pointed out, I can be more vulnerable to the virus, which means I could spread it more, which means I may expose other people to it. And the question becomes, am I now responsible for becoming a major spreader of the virus because I failed to vaccinate and I'm affecting other people? So this is a much more complex question, even in the context of general vaccinations like measles and things like that, where you had outbreaks because you had communities or large numbers of people who would not vax for measles and things like that. That's a much more complex question. Some Torah authorities say that you do have to vaccinate. Some say you don't. In the case of COVID, it's even more complex because by COVID, as Dr. Mogioris pointed out, most everyone, in general, those who are vaccinated have a much, much lower fatality or serious illness rate. And those who choose not to vaccinate have chosen not to vaccinate. Is it my responsibility? Okay. So if I don't want to vaccinate and someone says, well, you're going to infect the guy next door to you who's not vaccinated, is that my problem? Not necessarily. That's his choice. He could have. He didn't want to. And I'm choosing at the same time. So does it become a problem or not? That's a much more complex question. One could argue, but there are people who would like to vaccinate, but they can't because they have medical issues that prevent them. That also, I think, comes into the equation. That's I would imagine, a very small percentage of the population. Am I obligated to vaccinate so that I don't spread it, God forbid, to someone who would like to get vaccinated but cannot because of medical issues? Am I responsible for that? That is another question, which, again, different halachic rabbinic authorities have weighed in on different points. But I want to just go here for a few moments through a few sources quickly. Sources number 7, 8, 9, and 10. I'm not going to go through all them inside, but you can see them, those who are on Zoom and have a screen in front of them, you can see them for yourself. Okay? Basically, the upshot of sources 7, 8, 9, and 10 is just a few different details and scenarios of when we listen to a doctor. When it comes to a question of desecrating Shabbos or eating on Yom Kippur because a person's life is at risk, how do we determine that? Do we ask a rabbi? It doesn't say we ask a rabbi. It says we ask a doctor. The doctor has to give the opinion. And in fact, when it comes to danger to life specifically, if one doctor says you need to desecrate Shabbos because this person's life is in danger, and another doctor says, it's fine. So when we have a one-on-one, so then we go with the opinion that says desecrate the Shabbos. Okay? Source number 8, many later authorities agree. This is only true if they are both equal. If one is much greater in wisdom than the other, then we listen to him, whether to be stringent or lenient, because when the numbers are equal, we go after the majority of wisdom. Again, another example of just halacha, how halacha deals with doctors. But again, over here, the idea that a doctor who is considered far more expert, his opinion may bear much greater weight in terms of deciding what to do. Okay, and again, source number 9 and 10 goes into other cases of that as well. The upshot of all this that I'd like to bring out is that halacha says you ask the doctor. Now, in the world out there, you are being presented with opinions of doctors. People are, and I apologize if I'm wading into the politics a little bit, but I think this is what is being discussed on the street in terms of the question. From a Torah standpoint, should we vaccinate or not? There are two points we have to deal with. Point number one is that there are doctors who are coming out and saying this vaccine is unsafe. There's information that's not being shared with you. The studies are not being honest, and so on and so forth. And I want to be clear that historically, governments, even democratic governments, are not always straightforward in terms of sharing information. And it's not just about who really assassinated JFK. Okay, in any number, historically, there are no shortage of scandals of government cover-ups when the public interest was involved. And that is true for medical situations as well. Perhaps one of the more famous one was the famous, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, Tuskegee Institute study, which was a very racist study that took place in the first half of the 20th century, where black men who had contracted syphilis were studied and monitored for years so that doctors could track the progress of the disease. And they were told they're being treated when they were not. and it was a massive, massive scandal, they were lied to. And can such a thing happen again? Yes. But the question becomes, when you have doctors coming and saying, well, you're not being told this, you're not being told that. Okay, fine. But there are a lot of doctors, as Dr. Mogioris himself said, and a lot of data that indicates otherwise. So, number one, what's your evidence for these problems? Number two, how many doctors are there who are vouching for this evidence? And then we have to weigh it. And again, I'm not going to decide whom we should listen to. But just to quote doctors whom someone popped up, a doctor popped up and said, look at this and this and this and this, when other doctors are saying, but that's inaccurate for this reason and that reason and so on, the matter has to be studied, has to be analyzed, the data has to be analyzed. And ultimately, as it says over here, we have to look at the numbers. What are the majority of doctors saying? And which doctors are saying it? The ones who are experts in this area or doctors who are not necessarily experts in this area? It really has to be measured. Again, I'm not giving a final word on this. I'm just making the point that just to listen to any doctor who pops up and says, but you're not knowing this, or you're not reading that, or they're putting in this stuff or that stuff into the vaccine and so on and so forth. But again, the bottom line is, what is the data? What are the majority of doctors saying, and what are the expert doctors saying, is a major question which needs to be taken into account. Okay. And again, it says we ask the doctor. When a halachic authority makes a ruling, a responsible halachic authority is making a ruling based on what the doctors are saying, based on how halacha says we deal with doctors, which is a very logical, data-based, evidence-based process. And that is really what has to be followed. So that is a point I wanted to bring out just in terms of the tumult of people saying, well, this doctor said that. And if you look over here on this website, you'll see the CDC is hiding this information and so on and so forth. Again, halacha says, what are the doctors saying? What is the evidence? What is the majority of doctors saying? And that is how the decision ought to be made. Okay. I want to just on the flip side of this, and I will get more to halachic authorities in a moment. Source number 11. If you look at source number 11, this is again going back to, I believe, the beginning of the era of vaccinations. So here there was a conversation about where doctors said that there's an issue with the air. There's a change in the air, and change in the air exacerbates or causes disease. I don't know exactly all the details. It was a little hard to figure out from the material. But this is what is stated in a Sefer Knesset Yecheskel, who was a major halachic authority. He says, the matter needs study. If one may rely upon the doctors for this new thing, to say that his mind, meaning the doctor's mind, is broad enough to recognize a change of the air. What he's saying is, yes, we rely on a doctor. However, when a new idea crops up, a new idea comes up, and you are relying on a doctor's expertise, his wisdom, his ability to make a decision on something new, how far do you go relying on the doctor's say-so when it comes to desecrating Shabbos? And he says this, that for desecrating the Shabbos for an ill person, we rely on the doctor, for it's common that they will be in danger without the treatment of the doctors. What he's saying is, again, it's a little wordy and it's a little hard to pull out, but the basic idea that he's putting out is that when you have regular treatment that doctors do on a regular basis, and that area of medicine where the doctor is familiar and it's already well known, the doctor says, this particular issue, you have to desecrate Shabbos. Then we rely on the doctor because it's common, it's known, the doctor understands it, he's expert in it, it's already a well-known and a well-trodden path in terms of this issue. When it's something new, he's raising the question, how far do we go? And he's somewhat inconclusive, and some later authorities are also inconclusive because of this regarding the smallpox vaccination when it first came out. They invoke this source over here and say, if it's something new, how far do we go? This question ties back into the source number 5, God guards the fools, the simpletons, because as we said, you don't make yourself crazy trying to figure out every little problem that might have been missed or every conspiracy and so on and so forth. Once it becomes normative, we say God guards the simpletons, you do what's normal. The question is, when you have a new treatment, such as a COVID vaccine, which is a relatively new treatment, and yes, on the one hand, as Dr. Mogioris said, over 300 million doses given, so they have a pretty good idea what it's doing. At the same time, as Rabbi Haman, I believe, pointed out, it has happened that there are medicines out there, not vaccines per se, where 10, 20 years down the line, they find out that it has these long-lasting effects. It does happen. And so do you say Well, I don't care about that because this became the norm. Did it become the norm? Do we say, well, 300 million people had it and it seems to be safe, that's cool, became the norm? Or do you say you need more time? Okay, so one great authority, I'm not going to start naming names, one great Torah authority who is known to be more on the side of being cautious when it comes to vaccinating, I heard a very brief soundbite from him, and it's hard for me to know if it was in context or not, but he said, wait a year before you get the vaccination. Again, it was not in context. It was a soundbite. I don't know what the context was, but it would fit knowing that this individual is more cautious about vaccinations. It would fit with this context of when something is new, it's not necessarily the norm yet. Therefore, tread cautiously. Okay. And so that is a consideration. And I think that perhaps a lot of the tumult regarding some Torah authorities' hesitation regarding the vaccination may well come from this place. The great Klausenberger Rebbe, famous Holocaust survivor, who was one of the great Torah leaders of the previous generation, is quoted as having said, when asked about his grandchildren being vaccinated, he said, yes, they should be vaccinated, but they shouldn't be from the first 100 in line. Okay. The point being that yes, it's medicine. Yes, you go with the norm, but you don't have to be the first one in line. So ultimately, I think that the question of to be vaccinated or not boils down to what is the risk versus is it a close risk versus a distant risk? That's one factor. And certainly one could say that the vaccination is a distant risk vis-a-vis the risk of COVID itself. Okay. Even though, as Dr. Mogioris pointed out, there are deaths in younger in teens as well. But if I'm not mistaken, correct me if I'm wrong, the fatality rate is far less for those who get sick than the older you get, the more risk there is. So that may be a factor as well that some halachic authorities may say, if you're over this age, you're at higher risk, then you should vaccinate. If you're below this age, the risk is smaller. It's not worth it at this point. Wait longer before you vaccinate. Am I correct, incorrect on that statement?
It is correct that younger people survive. The survival rate among younger people is much higher. That is true.
Okay. So as I was saying, As I said, therefore that will be a factor. Again, I'm not giving a final ruling, just trying to provide a framework, of what the questions being dealt with within the halachic framework is how much of a risk is there versus the fact this is a relatively new treatment, even though there is a lot of experience. I have heard some major halachic authorities saying enough people have been vaccinated that we have a good enough idea and we can treat it as safe. Others are saying maybe wait longer. One other point I'd like to make before closing, and I know it's late and I apologize, but this is not a captive audience like it is in the deli. And if someone wants to go off, please go ahead. So I'll go a few minutes over and I apologize. One other one I want to make is this. People put out long lists of rabbis who said, don't vaccinate. Now, whether these rabbis, Torah authorities, halakha authorities actually said that or not is anyone's guess. Okay. I got an email from someone with a long list of, look at all these rabbis who said you shouldn't vaccinate. And I have to say that some of them, it's very hard for me to believe that they said it. And the vast majority of them, well, I'm sure they're wonderful people and Torah scholars, are not names of people who are internationally, who are world recognized as major Torah leaders. Why is that important? I want to explain. Okay. If I have my personal doctor, I go to my personal doctor and I ask my doctor my questions and I rely on my doctor. And that's my responsibility. That's my doctor. I make a responsible choice for who my doctor is and who my medical authority is, and I rely on them. When it comes to halacha, it's no different. A person needs to have a rav, a rabbi. You go and ask your questions to that rabbi. You don't go and pick and choose. I ask this question from this rabbi because he'll give me the answer I want. That rabbi, I'll ask that question because he'll give me the answer I want. According to Jewish law, you're not allowed to do that. You have one rabbi whom you are comfortable with, whom you are confident with, whom you feel is fit for the purpose of answering your questions, and you ask that rabbi your questions. If you go to your rabbi, okay, even if he is not the world authority rabbi, but he's a qualified Torah authority to answer your question, and he says, I looked into it, I spoke to the doctors, and according to Torah law, this is what I think you should or should not do, that is fine. However, to start running around collecting signatures of every rabbi on the entire planet who agrees with your agenda of either vaccinate or not vaccinate and put it up there and say, well, look at all these rabbis. One second. That's not the way you make a decision according to Torah law. If you have a major halachic authority, what we call a gadol hadar, one of the major Torah leaders, their word carries more weight because, just like, again, going back to medicine, you know, if you have the Surgeon General or the CDC, again, leaving all the politics out of it, just in a general sense, you have the overarching experts in the field who are world recognized as experts, their word carries more weight. By the same token, a worldwide recognized Torah authority, yes, his word will carry more weight. And when we'll call a second tier rabbi of a smaller congregation who is not of that stature, will take that into account. But just to compile lists of how many rabbis agree with my agenda of not to vaccinate, that is not how halacha determines an approach. A person that needs to go to his or her rabbi, if a person wants to know, what does God want me to do? So you speak to your doctor, and then you go to your rabbi, and you say, this is what the doctor said. Rabbi, what does God want me to do? And the rabbi gives you an educated answer based on his knowledge of the medical issue and based on his knowledge of what the Torah has to say. So I want to make that point as well, because just a lot of what I'm hearing going on is just people collecting signatures, and that's not the way halacha determines what should be done or not be done. Okay, so that is my presentation in today's class. And if Dr. Mogiris, if you have anything else you want to add or disagree with me, please. If anyone else has any questions, I'm happy to take them. And again, if anyone has to leave, please feel free. And if someone has a question, you have to unmute. Okay. So I left everyone speechless, I see. In that case, so I will thank everyone for coming. Thank you again, Dr. Mogiris, for giving of your time and expertise for this class in addition to the last one. And the bottom line is everyone should be healthy and everyone should be well. I want to wish everyone a Shana Tova, a Ksivach Sima Tova, a very happy and healthy New Year. And I look forward to, in the coming year, to having more interesting, I don't know if we'll get as controversial topics as this one, more interesting, exciting classes for Torah for Tycoons in 5782. So I will see you all next year. God willing, have a great Rosh Hashanah, have a great Shabbos, and have a good night. Thank you all.